Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Adelsky. Got my co-host here, super endocrinologist, Dr. Carl.
Oi, oi.
And with us today, we got a special guest, Dr. Henning Langer. He's a PhD over in Germany. He just came out with a paper from his brand new lab looking at GLP-1 medicines and muscle loss. And it's a really cool paper that kind of combines a few studies into one. So we shot him a message on Twitter, now known as X. I hate X. I call it Twitter. And he's like, I'll come on. And so this is brand new. We're like, we got to get him on because we've talked about this many times on the podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Henning.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for the nice introduction. Real pleasure to join you guys. Have listened to quite a couple of episodes that you uploaded, and really cool to be part of the team this time around.
Well, let's get into you. You have a lab. You've been all over the place. You were telling us before the podcast. You're at Big Pharma. You've studied under some people that have done protein metabolism, muscle metabolism. So now you have your own lab over in Germany. What got you into this?
Yeah, honestly, I think having my own lab has been the ultimate goal for quite the while. Everything that I've done since my undergrad degree, I did with a goal in mind, trying to get to the point where I have my own lab and followed the recommendations of my mentors and eventually have been lucky enough to get there and to have all these fantastic people that helped me on the way.
So how did you get involved with GLP-1 medicines and looking at protein metabolism exactly?
Yeah, so I have been really working on muscle wasting for the longest time, but the GLP-1 subject is only something that caught my attention more recently. And this is something that goes back to my time that I spent at Boehringer Ingelheim, where I worked in the in vivo department and was actually specifically hired to start diving into the subject of skeletal muscle during obesity and anti-obesity treatment. And so this is something that I really have to credit them with to a certain extent, and that I took with me now that I have my own lab at the Charité in Berlin.
That is cool. So cool. All right. Well, why don't we just get into this, as it's a cool, you know, because, yeah, you have multiple studies within the one paper. I'd love to just kind of have you conceptualize and
go into a little bit of the background. We've talked a lot about the background of this, starting from the semaglutide step one trial with the sub-analysis of DEXA scans and some concern. Is it possible that these medicines cause more skeletal muscle mass loss? We've talked about that with Grant Tinsley, but just go into what you guys did, because this is pretty fascinating how you did both rodent and human study.
Yeah, thank you for the kind words. Yeah, I think really the step one is the starting point of it all, to be honest. That's the thing that started to raise this concern, where you found that almost 40% of the weight loss was due to a decrease in lean body mass. And so that's a little bit more than what you would normally anticipate with physiological weight loss through lifestyle interventions, where commonly the rule of thumb is, according to the quarter fat-free mass rule, that around 25% only should be due to lean mass. And so that's very much based on historical data and different kinds of studies with different lengths. So overall, that's probably difficult to compare to an anti-obesity trial with incretins that is over 1 year long and has, you know, substantial weight loss way above 5 or 10%, which is commonly the main goal of most trials. So I'm still, up until today, I'm not really sure we can compare these two. But nevertheless, that's what gave rise to this idea that, oh, wow, maybe there's something going on that we don't want to be happening. And so that's really what fueled this idea that maybe there is muscle wasting occurring. And so actually, when you look at most studies, and that's also something important to consider, I think, the changes in lean body mass or fat-free mass or, you know, soft tissue, to be more accurate, that's something that isn't even approaching the 40% that the step one trial reported. So most incretin trials are actually, you know, right around those 25 to maybe 30% that the quarter fat-free mass rule would predict. But nevertheless, none of these trials have looked really at muscle directly. And so one of the things that we have been excited about is the question, what does really happen on the skeletal muscle mass level? Because, you know, lean body mass conflates a lot of different tissues and isn't really measuring muscle directly and, you know, not even talking about muscle function. But so we thought that that's something that needs to be addressed more directly. And of course, the most accurate way to do this is in the rodent, where you can take out the entire muscle and really look at it in detail, and where you can really control every single element that you're investigating. But we also wanted to really, you know, confirm our results to a certain extent in human beings. And so we partnered with the group of Phil Etherton and Iskandar Idris at the University of Nottingham, who have run a trial, patients on GLP-1, looking at muscle mass using ultrasound and measuring muscle force, so maximum voluntary contraction, these types of things, you know, like to go beyond, quotation marks, just measuring body composition and, you know, maybe hand grip strength or something like that. So we wanted to have something that's more directly addressing muscle.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Now, and you guys did in your background and discussion in this paper, before you get into it, you talked about how there were hints from some of the other studies that muscle function perhaps seemed to be retained already, like in, you know, like in the arthritis trial where people were moving better, quality of life tends to get better. And we've talked about, obviously, with all these medications over a long time, cardiometabolic health improves, you know, even if there was some reduced muscle mass. So I think that's an important background. And we've talked about that to nauseam. So I'm really excited to hear about the mouse part of this whole thing and the exercise program that they did after.
Yeah, I want to know how these mice exercise.
Yeah, the buff mice.
Yeah. No, so I think you bring up a really important point. So most studies actually report physical function as part of surveys or questionnaires. And so most of those obviously indicated that there is an actual net improvement with GLP-1 medicines, even if there is a decrease in lean body mass. And that's what you would expect, right? You lose fat, you lose a little bit of muscle too, but, or lean mass in that case, in those clinical trials. But if overall the muscle to load ratio improves, then, you know, per definition, those individuals should technically be moving better. And so that is something that we try to dive into in our rodent studies, where we put the animals on different type of incretin drugs and then tested how well they were running on the treadmill, for example. And we could find that some of the animals that actually had the biggest weight loss, and I reported some of that data even before we published this paper from a different study that we conducted while I was still at Boehringer Ingelheim, some of these animals looked almost cachectic in their cage. So they looked really, you know, almost frail because they lost so much body weight on some of these drugs, depending on the dosage, etc. So this is not an unexpected phenomenon, but in a dose-dependent and compound-dependent manner, some of these animals lost up to 30% or more, and they looked kind of, you know, rough around the edges in their cage. And we were like almost a little concerned, like, oh man, can we put these little guys on the treadmill, or is this maybe even too much for them? But honestly, these were the animals that ran the best. So that's, you know, I would have anticipated that maybe some of these animals lost a little too much weight, you know, and they were actually beyond the threshold of where it's healthy. but even the ones that look like they reached that point, when you put them on the treadmill and you let them run, they were actually outperforming the animals that had a little bit more fat still on their bones. So that is something that, to a certain extent, was surprising to us, because yes, you would anticipate that maybe if you decrease body weight, lose a little bit of muscle, but you know, disproportionate amount of fat, they run better. But the ones that were, you know, very lean and very skinny in the end, and were not really feeling like moving around in their cage much anymore, because you know they eat very little, they lose a lot of body weight. You will know this from your patients. The ones that you know lose the most body weight, maybe they're very disciplined and very motivated, but maybe they're not the ones that, you know, go out running every day, but they're maybe the ones that are a little more, you know, making sure in the kitchen that they don't eat too much. And so these animals not moving around, not very, you know, vigilant, but ran very, very impressively on the treadmill. So that was cool to see. And then later on, we actually did some biochemistry on the muscles of these animals, and we compare it to regular weight loss just through calorie restriction in mice. So similar weight loss between the animals. That's the pair feeding group, where we just reduced calorie intake. They had the same amount of chow as the mice that were on semaglutide treatment and voluntarily ate less because of the drug. And actually, you know, similar changes in body weight, similar changes in body fat, also a comparable decrease in muscle mass. But we did find some really interesting changes on the proteome level, where some mitochondrial genes were upregulated, or not genes, but proteins in this case. But some mitochondrial markers were up with the GLP-1 medicine. So that is something that has also been reported by some other labs in different contexts previously, that maybe there is a positive effect there. We don't know how that would be mediated, because you know, it's contentious whether there's even a GLP-1 receptor in muscle. But we did find these changes despite, you know, similar weight loss. So we thought that was some of the more interesting stuff that we brought into this paper, that there is a weight loss independent effect on muscle that may beget more of an endurance or, you know, fatigue resistance phenotype, which would also explain why these animals ran so well. But, you know, it's, so to a certain extent, that's speculation, but that's what we're most excited about.
Yeah, that's interesting. So
if any, they're going to put it on WADA.
Yeah.
That's what they're talking about. Instead of Ozempic, it's Ozempic mouse. But you used a few different agents. You used semaglutide, tirzepatide, and survodutide.
Yeah.
So a glucagon GLP-1 co-receptor agonist as well. So some differences there.
Which, for people out there, that one will be coming down the road a little bit later.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just interesting. Hi. So yeah, what were the different, because I went through the paper, you had like four different studies. One of them was human, but you had like three different mice. One you had to compare to caloric restriction by itself, and then a few other ones.
Yeah, no. So we had one study that's actually from Paul Tichenel back when he was still at the University of Pennsylvania, and Elizabeth Nunn, his PhD student. And she has done a study using tirzepatide against a regular control group, a relatively modest dose actually, but really impressive weight loss. I think within 14 days, these animals lost also around 30% body weight, maybe even a little bit more. And then so, you know, they dissected the skeletal muscle and looked at muscle mass. And you did find a significant decrease in muscle mass, maybe around 10% of the initial weight, or, you know, the weight that the control animals had. But actually, relative muscle mass, so the amount of muscle that these mice carried relative to their total body weight, increased significantly. So what we have is we have a mild decrease in muscle mass, but a really robust decrease in body fat, you know, driving the overall decrease in body weight, actually resulting in these animals having more muscle per body than before the intervention. And so in this study, we didn't do any exercising, no running or so. But we did, for example, look at the liver. And there we found that there was also substantial decrease in liver weight, which is something we are excited about because, you know, the liver obviously contains quite a bit of fat as well, which in obesity and with these anti-obesity drugs and MASH and MASLD, et cetera, is also relevant. But it also contains an awful lot of glycogen. And with every gram of glycogen, you have, you know, 3 to 4 grams of water bound to them, which is all lean mass, right? So if the liver, and particularly in mice, where the liver, you know, accounts for a little bit more of the total body weight than in humans, you know, relatively speaking, if you see that the liver goes down by, you know, 20, 30, in some of our studies, 50% or more, then that may explain also why you do see a robust decrease, well, not a robust, but a significant at least decrease in lean body mass without actually affecting skeletal muscle too much. So there's, what I'm trying to say is there's other organs that are also lean, you know, or predominantly lean yeah. tissues that are not contractile muscle protein necessary for, you know, using your muscles. And so if those are, you know, depleted at a faster rate than skeletal muscle, then that would also partially explain why maybe in some of these trials on the clinical level, you saw a bit more of a decrease in lean mass than you were anticipating because, you know, they seem to be efficient at decreasing liver weight and liver fat and liver glycogen and these sort of things as well.
That's a great point.
Yeah. That was one of the things we thought of. I mean, at least when Dr. Tinsley, he does body composition and, you know, he's talking about the DEXA and the different compartment models and how like, yeah, the DEXA scan doesn't look directly at muscle. So it's possibly glycogen differences. And that would probably be part of it then is what you're just explaining.
Yeah.
So, okay. So then what did you do with the mice in the next
experiment? The next experiment was, and there we actually partnered with a really great contract research organization in France, Biomeostasis, and Julian Rose is the head of that group. And, you know, what we did with them was we treated mice with semaglutide, also 10 nanomole per kg. So that's supposed to be the back translatable dose. People are discussing whether it's 3 nanomole or 10, but that's, you know, in the ballpark of the anti-obesity dose that humans would get. And we put mice on this and compared them to obese mice, but also, and I think that's the most interesting part about that experiment, to lifelong lean animals. So animals that were never obese, animals that didn't receive any obesity treatment, that were just on a regular chow diet that's, you know, carbohydrate rich, etc. And so we did the same thing. We ran a study for 2 weeks. We looked at changes in body composition. We found similar results as to what we saw in the tirzepatide study. We looked at changes in, you know, absolute and relative muscle mass. And there you could see that, you know, some of the lean animals did look a little bit better than the obese semaglutide treated animals. So, you know, the animals had a little bit more lean mass and a little bit more muscle mass compared to the ones that we treated with the GLP-1. And so that means that once you are obese, at least as a mouse, once you are obese and you treat them with these medicines, you know, they do lose fat predominantly. They lose a little bit of muscle, but they do not quite reach the level of muscle mass and health that you see in animals that were, you know, never obese in the first place. And so that was an interesting finding. Where's the, you know, where do you end up after you take GLP-1? And so it seems that you do get rid of the obesity phenotype to a certain extent, but don't necessarily match exactly somebody who has been, you know, healthy and lean their entire lives. Might not be necessarily surprising, but it's still something that was important to show. But what was a little bit surprising was the thing that I mentioned about the treadmill earlier, right? So we put them on the treadmill and we saw that despite, you know, this tendency to have a little bit more muscle than the lean controls, they were running almost as well, or at least not significantly different from the ones that were lean their entire lives and on a carbohydrate-rich diet, which I thought was exciting because that was a treadmill test to exhaustion also. And we also measured VO2 in these animals. And so it looked like there was this benefit of the GLP-1s that could not just be explained by fat loss alone. and certainly not by more muscle mass. If anything, they had like a little bit less muscle than the lean controls, but they were running just as well. So that was cool and kind of supported our idea that we generated through this proteomics data, where we found some of these mitochondrial proteins being up. So maybe there's something, you know, that we don't really understand fully yet, which I will happily admit, and I'll be excited to look more deeply into that in the future. But maybe there's something going on with GLP-1 and muscle that actually has some sort of a benefit to the proteome and to the mitochondria and things like that.
Very importantly, I sure hope you have some video of these mice running on the treadmill to exhaustion.
We do.
Yeah. And the next... And, oh, good, because we need to share that. And then the next thing we need to do is have Spencer run versus the mice on a treadmill.
Oh, man, I better train.
You know, yeah. I better train.
I would be...
They're going to kick your ass.
I would be super excited to see some actual functional data, maybe not from Spence, but from somebody who's on GLP-1 treatment on the treadmill, because that is really the data that I think we're missing. And, you know, as excited as I am about our paper, and as exciting as some of these studies that are coming out, like the bimagrumab trial and all of these things are, you know, nobody really had the resources and or the guts so far to run the study, you know, where you would do that with patients. Just put them on the freaking treadmill and show that they're running better after they had semaglutide. It doesn't even have to be a year, you know, like it could be. You do this for 12 weeks, you do this for 20 weeks, doesn't matter. I mean, even if the patients lose 5 to 10 kilograms, I would be shocked if they don't run better on the treadmill. And, you know, like we have, you know, people experience this, obviously, anecdotal evidence, people say this, and, you know,
yeah,
it makes so much sense. But we have a surprising sparsity, I think, of actual, you know, real life data that supports this. We have these questionnaires that you mentioned earlier, Carl, where, you know, people make ticks in the right boxes and say that, yeah, I think I move better than before and stuff like that. But there's surprisingly little on putting people on a treadmill, letting them lift weights and, you know, doing these things. And I'm excited to see what the future brings about this topic.
Let's do it.
Very cool. Yeah, I have some patients that are like machines now. They're doing like Iron Man, like it's crazy. I'm like, you're doing way more than I am.
Yeah, you know, maybe we have to think about.
We want
to
hear.
Maybe we have to think about testing them. You know, in the sense of PEDs, almost with the GLP-1s at this point.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
We want to hear how you like. We want to hear about the resistance training in these little mice and how you figure out their strength.
Were the mice doing some bench press?
not bench press, but...
I definitely need that video.
Yeah, no. You know, there you actually have to ask Troy Hornberger. He has this exciting model where he lets mice pull weighted pulleys and things like that. It's a really cool thing. We haven't set that up in our lab yet, but what we've done is we've done some... you know, contractile assays where we just really anesthetize the animals and then look at how much force they can exert when you put a certain amount of electricity through their nerve and or their muscles. So this is basically supra physiological, right? Because you really, people always talk about, you know, mind muscle connection and stuff like that. You take that out of the equation there, you just go straight for the kill, you know, like you go for high voltage directly on the nerve and using 100% of your muscle that's available. And so I don't know if you know that video of the guy who connected electrodes to the bar while he did a back squat or something like that and electrocuted himself. Not like that, you know, but similar concept. No, but you can do the same thing by taking out the muscle and just trying it in a dish. You know, you can attach the muscle to electrodes in a dish and then you put electricity through them and you see how hard can it contract still. And that's the cleanest way to assess how much force a muscle can truly exert, you know, because it's not how motivated is the mouse today and, you know, how keen is your patient on getting a new PR or anything like that. It's just like, it's a true value, a true physiological value. And there we found something that I think corroborated what we found on the more global level. We saw that the absolute strength tended to go down a little bit, but the muscles fatigued a little more slowly in the process. So, you know, in absolute terms, they went down a little bit, but relatively speaking, you know, that was in line with how much weight and how much muscle they lost. So no surprise there. You have a little bit less muscle. The muscle is in absolute terms not as strong as before. But if you put it in relative terms and how much the body, you know, still weighs, they were doing just as fine. But, you know, the really interesting part was, again, that they trended to be a little more fatigue resistant. So they showed a decline of force slightly later. And so that is something that, again, with some of the proteomics that we found and with some of the treadmill running that we saw, you know, we at least think that that makes sense to a certain extent, that maybe there is, you know, an actual net improvement in endurance in these muscles.
That's super interesting. Wow.
So if people are listening going, okay, how the heck do these mice, what does this mean for humans? But so you did a human component.
Yes. So you'll be excited to learn that that was actually the hardest part to get published. You know, we got so much pushback on that part on, you know, different levels. People were, you know, criticizing, not enough people, not enough this, not enough that. And I agree with that to a certain extent. You know, I don't have a problem saying like, this is not the final nail in the coffin there, or, you know, the big study that changes everything and you know, leads to nobody being worried about the muscle topic anymore. But I hope that at least it you know, validates to a certain extent some of the things that we saw in the mice. And, you know, it is so far one of the only studies that has looked directly at muscle. And so there's this other study that is a post hoc analysis of the tirzepatide trials, where they looked also with an MRI on muscle size and how much fatty infiltration there was in there. And they actually saw in that trial that there was a decrease in muscle size, but that has been in line with how much body weight these people lost. And they also found that there was a decrease in intramuscular fat, which is exciting because that's also something that to a certain extent predicts, you know, insulin sensitivity and things like that. So there was one study. Yeah, exactly. And so there's one study that went in that direction, but, you know, that study has not looked at muscle force. And, you know, with our colleagues from Nottingham, we actually looked at maximum voluntary contraction during knee extension. So like a true measure of how much force these patients could still exert with their legs. And then we also did hand grip strength, just because everybody always does that and it's easy to do. And, you know, at least within that limited time frame that we looked at these patients, we did not see a decrease that, you know, was significant. And we did not see that anything, you know, malign was going on. This was all as you would expect with the weight loss. There was nothing disproportionate happening. And I was happy to see that the bimagrumab trial essentially showed the same thing, right? The bimagrumab itself, which is a myostatin inhibitor or an ACTRB antagonist. And so that actually showed that even with semaglutide alone, there was also no decrease in hand grip strength or anything like that. And, you know, that's not to take away that maybe there is an avenue for muscle enhancing or muscle preserving compounds out there. I think that's still something that should be looked at and I think is exciting for the field. But in terms of how much the purely GLP-1 treated people lost in hand grip strength, there was no loss. You know, they maintained or even gained a little bit of hand grip strength. And you could say that, you know, hand grip isn't as sensitive, et cetera, and so on. But that's where I think our data is exciting, because I think if you look at maximum voluntary contraction of the knee extensors, that would be something that should be affected if there is an actual net loss in strength, but that wasn't the case. So, you know, that we thought confirmed what we saw on the rodent level.
Very awesome. Cool. So you're comforted by this. Are you doing more data and doing more studies into this?
Yeah. So, you know, we think this topic is here to stay, and we want to learn more about what it does to skeletal muscle. We also did in that paper that you mentioned, we did a study with immobilization, which we think is a clinically very relevant topic. We want to learn more about what GLP-1 does in the context of aging. I think that is the next big thing that we need to clarify, because we think right now, and we have no evidence, no data there, it's all circumstantial, but you know, there is some epidemiological studies out there that show that with aging, you do tend to lose muscle mass and become more frail disproportionately when you lose weight. So there is the point where weight loss, even if you are a little bit obese, isn't really helpful for patients anymore, because you know, it just reduces their reserves, and people have a higher risk of becoming sarcopenic and cachexic cachectic. And so we think there might be the point where, and I can tell you that the geriatricians on our ward at the hospital are really hesitant right now to prescribe older people the GLP-1s, because we just don't really know enough there. And I think that we need to delineate whether there is the point where maybe you need to be a bit more careful, or maybe you have to go with a lower dose, or maybe weight loss is really something you shouldn't be looking at, but you know, you should focus on other comorbidities. And that is, I think, something that we need to understand better. And the same goes for, you know, the fact that most people within a year stop taking the medication. So what happens during repeated weight cycles? What happens during repeated weight loss, weight regain cycles when you age? You know, that sort of thing. I think there's still a lot to learn, and we need to do more in that direction. And I know that some of the companies are to a certain extent interested in that, but also they have not really a big reason to look too deeply into something that could be shedding negative light on their compounds, right? So I think it'll be on real life doctors like you to explore this, and on academic researchers to understand a little bit better the nuance about where these compounds shine best.
Very cool. Yeah, we had Steve Heinsfeld, who did the BELIEVE trial just on prior, talking about the bimagrumab and semaglutide. Talking about, and Grant, Dr. Tinsley and I are doing a cohort. We're using hand grip strength. The only issue is subsequent hand grips. It's a skill thing. You might get better.
Yeah, there's a learning effect. Yeah.
So there's a little, I just want to put them through a usual strength training
program. I tried to submit that trial literally to Lilly to do a strength training arm. Lilly's but most listening. Importantly, everybody just needs to do some strength training.
Yes.
Everybody do some strength training.
No, I mean,
no matter what.
You know, whenever I talk about this subject, and you know, all those open questions that are still going on with GLP-1, etc., you know, I always finish my presentation by saying, look, we do have a way to preserve muscle mass during weight loss, and it's known and it's very well described. It's not even questionable or anything. I know I'm not trying to take anything away of these efforts to address this on a pharmacological level as well. But we know high protein, and we know even more so than protein, we know resistance exercise, lifting weights is, you know, helping with maintenance of muscle mass. And we know that approximately each of these components cuts the lean mass loss or the muscle loss in half during weight loss. So, you know, you can go from 40% to 20% to 10% total contribution of lean body mass during weight loss when you actually do proper, you know, resistance exercise. And I think, you know, that's where the Docs Who Lift podcast is really, really doing the right thing here and promoting the right combination of lifestyle and pharmacological treatments, because, you know, it's not one or the other. I think we know that obesity is a true, you know, chronic disease, even though some people are still struggling to accept that it's not just a choice thing. But I do think that to a larger extent, the lifting weights part, that's a choice thing or something that we can, you know, promote and help with through policies and stuff like that. And so I think that is probably the biggest lever that you have to maintain muscle and health throughout GLP-1s and life in general.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, we appreciate you coming on in such a timely manner because this just got published. I'm sure you put a lot of effort into writing this.
Congratulations, by the way. Very cool.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's a good one. So thanks so much for coming on. We're excited to kind of hear about what other stuff you got in your lab that's related to this. And anytime you come out with something, we're going to invite you back on. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. It's been a pleasure. And, you know, keep up the good work.
Very good. If anybody has friends or family that want to learn more about the muscle loss potential, want to get into the mechanics and proteomes, really detail, share this podcast with them and make sure Henning's on X if you want to follow him. I think, I don't know, you don't post that much there, but yeah, as well just follow him if you're interested.
No, happy to see new followers. And I haven't been posting that much recently since the change of the name and the leadership there, and you know, a couple of reasons. But I think it's still a good platform to communicate certain things and to stay up to date at least.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.